Recently, I went out to dinner with my wife. It was our wedding anniversary, so we thought we'd go to a nice place. And it was a nice place. The food was cooked well and simply. The menu was thankfully free of fussy, silly language until we got to the dessert. And at that point, the menu seemed to lose its mind. I ordered an item that was sort of described as a cheesecake. And then it arrived at the table. It came in this large glass tumbler, and within the tumbler was a portion of biscuit, a shiny white dollop of cream cheese, some scattered raspberries, and a blob of artisanal honey. The waiter looked a little bit embarrassed by this, and then he said helpfully, "It's a kind of deconstructed cheesecake." It's come to this, people. Is it possible to get dessert in this country that is unsupported by French critical theory? Stephen Poole has had enough of this hipper-than-thou and at times holier-than-thou cult of foodism. Stephen says that foodies, or foodists, as he calls them, have gone too far. Stephen's a British journalist. He's the author of several books, one on game culture called Trigger Happy and another on political language called Unspeak. And his latest book is an attack on what he sees as gastroculture gone mad. It's called, provocatively, You Aren't What You Eat, and he's in Australia as a guest of Adelaide Writers Week. Hello, Stephen. When you hear the phrase deconstructed cheesecake, what do you think of that?
It sounds like instead of giving you a knife and fork, they should give you a blender, and they're actually forcing you to do some of the labour of making the food. But people pay extra for this now. It reminds me of a couple of Christmases ago, you could get a Christmas cake by Delia Smith in the posh supermarket Waitrose in England. And this was different because it was a kind of deconstructed Christmas cake that you had to make yourself. So all the ingredients were pre-weighed in different sachets, and you actually had to mix it and bake it yourself. But people will, and this cake cost more than a ready-made cake that didn't have the Delia Smith brand on it. And I think it's because everyone's jobs now, increasingly, are a kind of virtual reality with no concrete product. So people will pay extra for the chance to play at being an artisanal labourer.
I put it out on Twitter, because such moments are made for Twitter, that I'd just been served a deconstructed cheesecake, and I asked how such a thing should be eaten, and I got wonderful replies, like, with an imaginary fork. Someone said, on a palimpsest, and someone else said, and yet the existence of cheese/cake demonstrates the cake-cheese distinction is an arbitrary construction. There does seem to be this kind of... food is branching well beyond what's on the plate, it seems, and seems to need to have a kind of a theory behind it.
Yeah, because you need to justify the insanely high prices you're charging in a posh restaurant. So you need to have, you know, crazy things on the menu that make people think they're getting something really exclusive. So the gastropub near me in London recently opened up with strange things on the menu like blowtorch lettuce in their wraps. And you used to imagine the chef sitting around one evening thinking, well, flicking the blowtorch on and off, thinking, we've got this blowtorch and we only use it for creme caramel. Isn't that really boring? What else could we set on fire? Ah! And somebody, some bright spark says, let's set the lettuce on fire. Oh, yeah, that's got to be delicious, right?
Lettuce is 99% water, isn't it? What is left? Is it like this, a fibre or something,
I suppose? That's a good question. I didn't dare to order it and find out.
Your book seems to be the product of a long simmering rage. Was there any one thing that was the straw that broke? I keep getting into food metaphors here, that made you had a gutful. That led you to say, I've had a gutful, Stephen.
I was sitting outside a cafe in London and this bus rolled by and there was an advert on the bus to the effect that if you don't buy this incredibly expensive organic heirloom tomato from Alf's posh supermarket, then your family will hate you forever. This is the only way to get your family's affection and loyalty.
But it doesn't say it like that, though, does it?
No, it doesn't say it. It says something like love food, love your family, love life. But I think the implied message is a kind of emotional blackmail. Like, this is the if and only if you buy this produce, will you be able to love your family in the correct way? And this struck me. All of a sudden, I saw the sanctimony and the moralism of the foodists. Not only do they have food as their own hobby, which is fine, everyone has a hobby. Some people play with model train sets. Some people play with food in their kitchens. I don't find that offensive. But when they're trying to ram it down our throats, quite literally, actually, but when they're trying to tell us that we have to be as interested in food as they are, and we have to spend 3 hours every evening cooking and preparing a meal, or there's something wrong with us and we're somehow inferior, then I do find that offensive.
What kind of field research did you do?
I did go out into the field.
Did you?
To eat some strange foods. And I tried to eat at both ends of the spectrum. So I did go to McDonald's and ate a special edition burger that they called the 1955 burger, which was supposed to celebrate the founding of the first restaurant by Ray Kroc, who founded the McDonald's chain. chain. And it was fascinating. It was a kind of virtual reality burger because it looked more like a proper burger than a Big Mac or something. And when you bit into it, the initial second of taste was really, ooh, this tastes like a proper hamburger, grilled onions, kind of char-grilled meat. And then it vanished almost instantly, and you felt curiously empty. So then you had to take another bite, and you got that 1 second of taste again, and then it went away. So you kept on biting, and by the end, you felt curiously empty because you just had a kind of simulation of a burger. But it was kind of fascinating, and the mad scientists in the McDonald's laboratory somewhere had obviously done their job very well. And then I went out also to an incredibly expensive molecular gastronomy restaurant, where they served us 18 courses of joke food. It was like, you know, circus tent food thing, a tiny bit of roasted celeriac served on a warm stone, of course. And next to it, this just little dollop of foam, which I remember the next day when I was writing it up, I saw my notes in my notebook. I described it as roasted celeriac with shaving foam. And that's actually what it tasted like. I don't know if you shave with Gillette citrus-scented foam and you get a bit in your mouth sometimes in the morning, that's what it was like. But, you know, but this cost £200.
When you're speaking there about McDonald's, it just occurred to me that foodieism has infected McDonald's too. And insofar as in Australia there's a campaign to have a kind of an upmarket McDonald's burger that is served with Angus beef. And the slogan is, it's a little bit fancy. McDonald's!
The big growth in the market is in gourmet food, gourmet versions of junk food. So gourmet popcorn is a big thing now. In England, gourmet frozen yogurt is everywhere.
There can be no such thing as gourmet popcorn, can there? Can it really?
Apparently there is. I've never had any, but it's like, it's popcorn, but just in fancier packaging and more expensive.
Right, with wasabi or something.
Yeah.
When you read stuff on a menu, does what you read on that menu alter your experience of the food?
Apparently it does. This is a really interesting fact. There's a kind of psycholinguistic power to the descriptions. And they did an experiment about this with a dish by Heston Blumenthal, the famous molecular gastronomy guy. He's got a dish called crab ice cream. And they took two groups of people and they told one group, okay, you're going to eat some ice cream now. And they told the other group, you're going to eat a savory mousse. And then they gave the same thing to both groups of people. Now, the people who were expecting to have ice cream said this was the most disgusting thing they've ever tasted because it was, you know, it didn't taste sweet like ice cream. But the people who thought it was going to be a savory mousse really enjoyed it. And it was exactly the same thing. So the framing, the priming mentally of the menu language is interesting. And it's a species of literature in itself. The same gastropub that does the blowtorch lettuce. It also serves Machiavelli eggs. And I looked at that and I thought, okay, what is this? The hens are particularly Machiavellian. They're really they're tricky hens. They'll do what you don't expect. Maybe they'll lay an egg, but they'll lay it where you'll never find it. Or they'll lay something that looks like an egg, but it's actually a hand grenade. So you just go off on these sort of fantasies, and it's quite exciting until you actually, though you'll serve the food, and the waiter explains, I didn't actually order this, but I asked the chef, well, it's just a species of chicken from Italy, so it's not that exciting after all.
One thing you have noticed, which is kind of, I've seen this a couple of times too, in some gastropubs and some high-end eating establishments, they'll serve not eggs, but hen's eggs. Called hen's eggs.
Yeah, I saw that once, and I was really confused. I thought, what is a hen's egg? For a couple of seconds, and I realised, oh yeah, they just mean eggs.
Eggs.
But you have to re-specify it now because people are so used to having eggs from other animals, like ostrich eggs or crocodile eggs or dinosaur eggs, as it may be. So if it's just ordinary eggs, you have to say hen's eggs, and somehow that also makes it sound a bit more exact and exclusive.
Tell me what you think is behind the outbreak of baby this and baby that on a menu. You know, baby spinach, baby carrots, baby spring lamb, baby this, baby that. What's the thinking behind that?
Well, it's strange because, yeah, there's a dish, baby scallops resting on a bed of baby greens. And it sounds sort of cute and unthreatening, but at the same time, if you think about it, one doesn't really want to eat babies. These things have been murdered for your pleasure. So you don't want to think that you're sort of a kind of cannibalistic version of King Herod. But that's what the language implies. So and you have stacks of babies one on top of the other. And, of course, if you say a baby scallop is resting on a bed, that's not really true either, is it? Because it's dead. It's dead. It's not resting. And, you know, the spinach isn't a bed. It's just it's a kind of vegetable coffin.
But babies, in our mind, are sinless. You know, that's why babies, the dyer's babies, go directly to heaven in the old theology, isn't it? So they're virtuous, aren't they?
Do you think there's
virtue?
Yeah. So maybe by consuming them, we're consuming their virtue and becoming more innocent ourselves.
I want to play something now from the British comedy series Posh Nosh, which has Richard E. Grant playing Simon Marchmont and his wife, Minty Marchmont, that run a restaurant somewhere in the home counties called the Quill and Tassel. Here we are. This is them talking about how to make leftover chicken.
We're going to do leftover roast chicken with parsnip and watercress salad leftovers with leftover wine and leftover bread.
Now for the chicken. From our friend Arthur Legg Bourke's farm, Burke's Farm near Banbury, this is Jessica. We adopted Jessica when she was just a chick.
Always have a relationship with your meat.
Take a 67-gram lump of organic unsalted organic butter, grill some colour of night pepper, wind-dried salt, tarragon, savaged, from our walled garden, brando your butter in the chicken's world of interior. And then mollify its complexion with more butter.
Just think of it as giving someone a massage.
Arga sweat your chicken at 200 when your chicken is noblesse oblige, embarrass a leg and some décolletage and disenfranchise.
That's marvellous, isn't it? Brando your butter into the chicken's world of interior is a very obscure little joke there, but one that works for me. I think
personally, I do that every evening.
The message there in that, it seems to be a parody of the idea that you must respect the meats. This is language you're hearing more and more often now.
When I was researching the book and reading all the cookbooks and watching all the TV shows, this was a theme that cropped up repeatedly. You must respect the food. And there was an edition of MasterChef where people had to prepare a pigeon for roasting. And after one guy did particularly well, the judge said, oh yeah, he showed that pigeon the respect it deserved. Well, apparently the respect it deserved was to have its wings cut off with scissors and its head chopped off and its stumps trussed to its breast before it was shoved in a hot oven. Does that sound very respectful? Not really. So it's a strange idea that we're respecting animals by killing them and then stuffing them into our stomachs.
Again, the psychology behind that seems to imply that the chicken is there for us. The pigeon is there for us. Its whole purpose of existence. It's grown itself to this state to offer itself up to be killed for our enjoyment, so we're obliged to respect the chicken's intentions, the pigeon's intentions, which is to have itself killed for our pleasure.
Yeah, there's a kind of teleology to it, or even a kind of spilt theology. The world is created for our comfort and our pleasure, and so if we refuse to enjoy all the pleasure that the world's available, that's available to us in the world, then we're somehow in the wrong.
There are overtones of class in that as well, which I think is always important when you're talking about British culture, particularly, everywhere to some degree, but particularly so with British culture. Do you hear those overtones of class? I mean, for example, in another episode of Posh Nosh, they don't make builders' fish and chips, they make architects' fish and chips.
Oh, yeah, there's a terrible snobbery. I was doing a debate at the London Restaurant Festival a couple of months ago, and during the question and answer session, a woman popped up in the audience and said, well, you know, the problem is, how do we educate the British public's taste? And the chair asked her what exactly she meant. She said, well, you know, I go to the supermarket and I see people buying second-rate Parmesan. And I was like, really? This is what keeps you up at night? The fact that somewhere, some people are buying cheese that you don't think is of the highest quality. So there is a snobbery. And it's a shame because people criticise the eating choices of others while not being able to imagine the way in which their lives might be more constrained.
Well, I suppose one thing we do know is that people on lower incomes consume more processed food, mm-hmm. the stuff that's in the middle of the supermarket rather than the periphery, mainly because perhaps it's cheaper.
Yeah.
I don't know, is there an education issue there or is there a nutrition issue there? Don't you think there is a point underneath that snobbery, there is a point about eating habits of people on from low-income families?
Well, a lot of times it is just cheaper. And, you know, fresh fruit and vegetables in the supermarkets are actually quite expensive. And if you don't have a local greengrocer's, that's your only option. And, you know, we had this horse meat scandal in the UK recently. So it turns out all our frozen supermarket lasagnas, even our Swedish meatballs from IKEA's, they all contain like 99% horse. And of course, horse is not poisonous. So, you know, nobody died or got ill because of this. But it's a labelling issue that made some people a bit uncomfortable. But, you know, the food writers and the restaurant critics all started saying, well, it serves those people right, you know, that they shouldn't have been eating frozen lasagna in the first place. I would never touch such garbage. And, you know, there's something rather sanctimonious about that. And then I was, you know, I was also doing an interview about the horse meat scandal. And I said, look, you know, some people work two jobs. They can't get to their organic local butcher. Maybe they don't even have one because they lived in a deprived inner city area. So, you know, they're exhausted mentally and physically when they get home. So they slam something in the microwave. What's so wrong with that? And there was this stream on Twitter afterwards of these middle-class Radio 4 listeners going, I don't believe that. These people are just fat and lazy and stupid, and they'd rather just slob out in front of EastEnders or a soap opera than cook themselves some nourishing food. And yet there's just a kind of lack of sympathy a lot of the time.
I think any time you hear a sentence that begins with these people or those people, yeah. What's going to follow isn't going to be too good, is it? There's two aspects to this, it seems, from reading your book, which is that there's the hipper-than-thou crowd and the holier-than-thou crowd. Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about the hipper-than-thou crowd. You attended something called a food rave. What is a food rave, Stephen?
Well, that's what I wanted to know. So I went to it. I found it on the internet. And it turns out to be a nice woman who knows about food opens her lovely North London two-bedroom flat with a garden to loads of artisanal food producers. And she charges £5 a ticket. And you go along and you go into the garden and you taste the kimchi burgers and you taste the artisanal chocolate. And everyone seems to have a rather middle-class, nice time. Perfectly pleasant, but I was just a bit disappointed by the fact that this is apparently now what passes for a rave. This is the idea of counterculture for people in their 20s in London. It's not punk rock. It's not dancing to repetitive beats. It's just going to stuff your face with exotic food.
Do people who attend such things really think they're doing something that's transgressive, that's kind of culturally a bit edgy and dangerous?
I think they do, because there was, you know, there was all kinds of other slightly alternative stuff going on. There was a woman reading tarot cards in one corner, and there was a hipster who came out who obviously had gone simply so he could feel superior. So he was criticising, you know, he said the arancinis weren't quite spicy enough, you know, he knows the authentic version of these exotic dishes, and he didn't think they were doing it right.
Oh, that's like the guy who says, you know, I'm not so much into Joy Division, I was into Warsaw, you know, their earlier incarnation.
Exactly.
Or I like this band early.
This
early
guy was eating arancinis before they were fashionable.
Yeah.
And he told me he recently tried to do that thing that of cooking the whole lamb with the hay. Apparently that was a thing, but you know,
you cook that with hay now?
With hay. Hay is the big new thing, but apparently he created some kind of hay-based inferno and his animal was completely charred and inedible by the end, which is a small tragedy for him.
That's not respecting the meat, I would
say. No, it isn't. He showed a terrible lack of respect.
Incinerating his animal with hay. What do you think of the word foodie, anyway? Foodie, that's used a lot these days.
I think there's a kind of cloying, infantile quality to it, somehow, you know, regressing to just a kind of infant love of pleasure for its own sake and not really thinking, which is why I choose not to use the word foodie, and I prefer to call them foodists, because it sounds ruder and there's more of a taint of ideology, like sexist. And I think foodists are, they do have a kind of overarching ideology, because they think, a lot of them do think that food is the most important thing you can spend your waking hours doing. And I would just say, you know, maybe for you, but don't tell us what we could be doing, because other people have different interests.
Do you get a sense that then a kind of obsession with food or foodist culture or foodism is a kind of diversion from real culture?
I do. I think it's become a fetish, and it's become a way of displaying your superior discrimination. And it's become, you know, eating the right kind of food at a fashionable restaurant, it's become the equivalent of carrying the right kind of designer handbag. It really is all about conspicuous consumption. And the people who tell us that we can get all our spiritual sustenance and our intellectual sustenance as well as our actual nutrition from food, I think they're a bit crazy.
Maybe it's a way, it's a bit like, you know, real estate has that habit too. It tends to displace other kinds of conversation around a table. Talking about food would normally be, you'd talk about politics, art, music, sport, culture in general, and books. You'd instead talk about food.
It's rather tedious. People have been telling me while I've been in Australia that, you know, they go to dinner parties in Melbourne and it's changed, and the people who are giving the dinner party are just really anxious. Have they got the food correct? And then everyone talks about the food for the whole evening. And, you know, there were days when we talked about more interesting things.
It's a bit self-conscious too, isn't it? I don't know how you can enjoy something authentically when you're talking about while you're enjoying it.
No, when you're deconstructing it.
When you're deconstructing it, indeed. Then there's the holier-than-thou aspect to it. Tell me why you think some food books might be better placed in the self-help section of the bookshop, Stephen?
Well, I mean, there's this kind of spiritual idea that if you eat the right kind of food in the right kind of way, then you're getting back to nature. And you can see the attractiveness of the idea. You're just reconnecting to the land in origin, a slightly fascist way, if you trace the origins of organic farming back. But you can see why it's nice. And there's also a strand of foodism to do with eating the right kinds of superfoods now. You know, we all have the right kind of berries, the right kind of seaweed. Weed is going to change your life and make you incredibly healthy for the rest of your life, and essentially you'll never die, is the idea. So that people write these food Bibles, these like optimum nutrition Bibles, and you know, new, better optimum nutrition Bible. And there's all this kind of pseudoscience about some new berry that were, you know, eaten by the tribesmen in some savannah somewhere who always lived to the age of 320. And the idea is that, you know, you can control your fate by controlling what you put into your body. But sadly, this is nonsense, because you could just get run over by a bus tomorrow.
I'm pretty certain we won't be talking about goji berries 15 years from now.
No, indeed. But this is a strand of foodism that some psychologists say is a new eating disorder. They call it orthorexia, from the Greek orthos, meaning correct. And the idea is that, you know, for some people, they are so obsessed with the berries and, you know, stuff. And it's very antisocial as well, because if they go to dinner parties, they can't eat what they're given. They have to get out their little plastic sachets of whatever they have with them and eat their own foods. And so the idea, it's a bit like Christian Science. You know, the idea is if you get sick, it's your own fault because you're a sinner. But if you do the right thing, you will live forever.
What's the flip side of that idea, that the right kind of foods heal you spiritually? Not physically, but spiritually.
Well, the flip side, I suppose, is that eating the wrong kinds of foods makes you,
bad.
Morally degraded. So the foodists, all, you know, they're always criticising the habits of the great unwashed masses who eat what they call junk food or processed food. But, you know, I'd rather like to stand up for food processing. I think it's a marvellous division of labour. So if I can get a ready meal from the supermarket, it's created by experts in food science, and I'm pretty sure what's in it isn't going to kill me, because we have very strict food safety standards. And, you know, I'd rather not know what's in it, frankly.
So then there was this idea that if people who eat bad food, they're the deserving poor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because they can't be bothered to learn how to cook. It's their own fault if they die early.
What do you think is the real human impulse at the root of this interest in nutritional consciousness, like being fully aware of, utterly aware of the nutritional components of whatever it is you're eating?
I think it's, again, it's a kind of control, because the world is so chaotic and crazy outside. So the idea of, even the idea of an ordinary cookbook is a dream of domestic comfort and control. And the idea that if you're skilled at cooking and you have the right cookbooks and the well-equipped kitchen, you can always create a zone of safety and pleasure for yourself. And if you go further, and if you're really interested in nutrition, you can somehow keep your body young and vivacious indefinitely.
Is it similar to the fitness freak? Fitness freak who punishes themselves.
I suppose it is, but it's the inward-looking version of the fitness freak who's all about, you know, doing the muscles and the external display, and then the person who's obsessed with nutrition is obsessed with what's going on in their colons.
One of the things I find troubling in these kind of nutritionist discussions is this obsession with purity as well. The idea of the body being the temple. Your body is not a temple. Your body is not pure. It houses all sorts of incredibly foul things and 19 million species of bacteria in order to actually be able to digest food.
My body is a fun. Unfair.
That's right. Yes, exactly. My body's a forest floor, really. I mean, that's the truth of it. Trying to make your body...
There are more bacterial cells in your body than human cells.
Oh, yes. And you know, human bodies are occasionally disgusting.
Yeah.
And it seems to be, I don't know, this nutritionism seems to want to deny it or hold it, that disgustingness, if that's the word, at bay.
Yeah, that's right. In that sense, it's kind of holdover from Christian asceticism, you know, denying the flesh and purging the flesh of sin.
You found there's the ambitions of a lot of celebrity cooks and chefs. It seems to be extending themselves into all sorts of different directions. You've uncovered something called the Lima Statement. Who are some of the people behind the Lima Statement?
The Lima Declaration by the world's top chefs, who called themselves the G9, as though they were a nation state or some kind of geopolitical country. It was Ferran Adrià, the famous molecular gastronomy chef from the Spanish restaurant,
right, yeah.
El Bulli, and René Redzepi, the guy who forages stuff and serves you twigs on a plate in Copenhagen. And they They announced this communique, this declaration, an open letter to the chefs of tomorrow, and it was all about through our cooking we can not only change how people eat, but we can save people's culture, we can save the environment, we can save the world spirit. It was almost Hegelian.
I've got a quote here, and I want to read. This is from the Lima declaration. A cook ought to be socially engaged, conscious of, and responsible for his or her contribution to a fair and sustainable society. And moreover, through our cooking, our ethics, and our aesthetics, we can contribute to the culture and identity of a people, a region, a country, and we all have a responsibility to know and protect nature. Wow. I have to say, that's ambitious.
Yeah, they're going to save the planet, apparently, single-handed.
By cooking.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
What forces are at work in the mind that creates that kind of a statement, do you think? Megalomania or...
Well, I'm not a psychotherapist, so I wouldn't like to try and diagnose anyone.
I'll have a go anyway, would you?
But
let's do it anyway.
It's a kind of... Well, I mean, they've been put on such a pedestal by the media, everyone telling them, oh, you're literally a genius because you create this kind of froth, or you've figured out how to make a tomato explode with a bicycle pump, which was one of Ferran Adrià's inventions. Everyone's telling them they're geniuses. Obviously, it goes to their heads.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Stephen Paul is the author of You Aren't What You Eat, Fed Up with Gastroculture. Stephen, the title of your book is the inverse of another very, very successful book that was called You Are What You Eat by Gillian McKeith. I'm not quite sure how you pronounce her name, but what's your beef with this fine, upstanding woman?
My beef with Gillian McKeith is my beef with everyone who calls themselves a nutritionist in Britain, because, as it turns out, it's not a protected term. You can have no qualifications in anything and still call yourself a nutritionist. And, in fact, Gillian McKeith used to style herself Dr. Gillian McKeith until somebody did a little digging and discovered she'd got her doctorate by mail order from some obscure American college. So the Advertising Standards Authority had to tell her she had to stop calling herself a doctor because people thought she was a medical doctor.
This is opposed to dieticians that do need some kind
of qualifications. Are actually, they have to, actually study the science, and they work in hospitals. So Gillian McKeith, she's one of these nutritionists who, every few years comes out with a new nutrition Bible that tells you, oh, you must eat these new superfoods now. And she's very interested in what comes out of the other end. She had a TV program where she would literally examine people's stools and diagnose their problems. By sight of that, which is, I
Who would volunteer for such a job?
I don't know. She made a lot of money out of it, I suppose. Oh. That was one reason why you would do it.
More and more products are being labelled gluten-free for the benefit of people who are celiac, people who can't digest gluten. That seems like a really good idea to me. What's your problem with that?
It does. Well, what's interesting is that the incidence of celiac disease appears to be rising, and nobody knows why. But the amount of people choosing to eat gluten-free products seems to be much greater than the number of people who actually are intolerant of gluten. So it's become, although it's a real thing, it's actually become a fashion as well. And I think partly because the tennis player Djokovic has announced that he went gluten-free and then he suddenly started winning all the Grand Slams, so it obviously makes you superhumanly athletic, and it's another kind of lifestyle choice now, like going dairy free even if you're not actually allergic to milk products. It's people, the word free itself, it's not saying contains no gluten, it says gluten free, and that puts you in mind of somehow liberating.
Well, it's like an additive or something, like gluten is an additive.
Yeah, but yes. They even label foods gluten free that never contained gluten in the first place.
Right. So it's like we haven't added gluten to this.
Yeah.
Therefore, it's gluten-free. Intolerances. There's a rising number, seemingly, of food intolerances. Now, there's all sorts of theories about that, too. That's due to increased pesticides in the biosphere, all sorts of reasons for that. But do you see something else in that?
Yeah, more and more people are claiming to be intolerant of foods that nobody, there's no physiological basis for being. So there's a physiological basis for celiac disease. And if you're allergic to dairy products, that's because you don't have the enzyme lactase, which human beings took 10,000 years to evolve after they started keeping cows. But someone like Gillian McKeith, you can send off for her quack doctor food allergy testing kit, or you used to be able to. I think they actually stopped her doing that. And she would tell you you'd be, you're intolerant to apples. Or
right.
you're intolerant of something completely normal that nobody actually is allergic to.
So she'd help you diagnose a problem and then offer you a solution.
So these people are kind of like witch doctors, people perhaps with, you know, psychic and emotional problems, would think, well, if I only acquire the right nutritional advice,
then I'll take apples out of my diet,
then I will feel better in an emotional way as well as a physical way. I think that's the idea. That's the promise.
Is there anything that's all that new to be found out? I mean, you mentioned there like new food discoveries that come through, new nutritional discoveries to be made about food. How much good science is behind that, do you think?
Everybody already knows and has for a long time how to eat healthily. And it's summed up in the words of Michael Pollan, the American food writer. He says, eat food, mostly plants, not too much.
That's very good. I think that's very, very impressive, I think.
Everyone knows you just eat fresh vegetables, not too much meat, do some exercise. That's how to eat healthily. It's not rocket science.
So when you hear...
But people have to sell a new nutritional Bible every couple of years, so they almost have to invent new discoveries.
Yeah, and you know, there's this kind of spurious new research that comes out all the time, and sadly radio is not immune to it. There's another... I keep using these metaphors, don't I? But where chocolate... Turns out chocolate's good for you, then replaced by another story. Turns out chocolate's bad for you. Turns out chocolate's good for you. And you can exchange that for red wine or coffee, and these things turn around and become a kind of radio talking point year after year after year after year. And finding out who's actually spruiking this so-called research is often very interesting too.
Is it people who make red wine and coffee?
Sometimes, yes. Or some spurious institute.
Right.
And who's funding the institute is often what needs to be looked into.
Yeah, well, it's like Aristotle said, everything in moderation, a bit of red wine, a bit of coffee, where's the harm? And also I discovered when writing this book, it turns out that, you know, a lot of foodists really hate coffee. And to me, that's the sign of a maniac. I mean, what if they say coffee is some terrible poison and you shouldn't even have any. One guy who belongs to the Soil Association in the UK, the organic farming thing, he actually says if you drink a cup of coffee, that changes your DNA. It'll screw up your genome and you'll pass that down to your children, you'll pass that down to your grandchildren. So it's this emotional blackmail again. If you eat what he calls junk or even have a cup of coffee, you're ruining your whole bloodline.
Is there any science to support the claim that coffee can change your DNA?
Not that I know of, but then it's not about science, it's about pseudoscience. It's about this pseudo-holistic relationship of the land to the bloodline. Well, that's where organic farming, you know, comes from. It comes from British farmers in the 40s worrying that if the produce got worse and the use of the land got worse, then the national bloodline would become inferior. So it's a rather, you know, rather similar to what the Nazis were thinking at the same time.
Yeah, well, you mentioned then earlier that there were slightly fascistic origins of the organic farming community. Is that the word I'm looking for? In Britain, do you mean literally fascistic, as in like black shirt wearing?
One of the guys who founded the organic movement in the Soil Association was actually a member of the British Union of Fascists. Yeah, so, I mean, there's a direct link there.
So there's this connection with blood and soil and the sturdy British race that emerges from that.
And, of course, I don't want to call everyone who buys organic food a fascist.
No.
You know, and there are plenty of sensible things that organic farmers do. We shouldn't put too many growth hormones in the beast we eat. We shouldn't use too many fertilisers.
One thing the Nazis were prone to was pseudoscience, though, wasn't it?
So. Absolutely, yeah. And they were also extreme health fanatics.
The chef as the artist. More chefs are claiming the title of artist for themselves. Why do you think that's so wrong-headed? I mean, it's a sensory experience, enjoying a beautiful, exquisite, and interesting meal, isn't it? It's a truly sensory experience. It just happens in the mouth and the nose rather than in the ears and the eyes, for example.
Yeah, but I don't think something can be art just because of the sensory experience, because I can go out in the park and feel the sun on my face and that feels really nice, but that's not art. I mean, who's the artist? And, of course, you can play around with food and make a castle out of marzipan, as one of the great French chefs used to in the 19th century, but that's kind of sculpting stuff out of food as you would sculpt stuff out of plasticine. That doesn't make it art either. And, I mean, art is something that you can go back to and appreciate and see more things in every time, but once you eat a meal, it's gone. You can't regurgitate and throw it back up onto your plate and then eat it again and say, oh, this is even better than the first time. No, because it'll taste kind of manky.
But I suppose for all the people who want to claim the title as the chef as artist, there are more than there's the many, many thousands and millions of their grateful diners who want to call them this, who want to call them artists.
Well, presumably because they don't want to be so challenged, you know, they don't want to do something difficult like go to see the opera or actually read a book. So if they can pat themselves on the back by saying, well, I went out to dinner tonight, I experienced some great art, it's a much easier way of getting that cultural cachet, isn't it?
Yeah. I suppose I gave this a bit of thought. And art has to at times be uncomfortable and painful. And
I don't suppose you'd ever want a meal to be that, would you?
No. I mean, you want a meal to be nice, unless it's a kind of concept meal. So René Redzepi, the cook at Noma, allegedly now the world's best cook, who does all this foraging stuff and, like, serves you twigs, he came over to London and he did a pop-up at Harrods, the expensive department store, and one of the dishes he served there for his £150 tasting menu for lunch was a lettuce leaf with live ants crawling all over it.
When you ate the ants?
That is rather slightly disturbing. Mm. You did eat the ants. I didn't eat them myself, but apparently they were sort of crunchy and lemony. But tragically, there were little blobs of salad cream on the lettuce leaves, so some of the ants got their legs stuck and were just left there waving their legs, sadly, until they got eaten. So that is more challenging, I suppose, than a nice pie.
Or somewhat more expensive, too, to have your ants on your lettuce like that. I suppose this is all a bit of a build-up towards one important figure, which is Heston Blumenthal.
Yes.
A man who likes the idea of food as a multimedia experience. Dinner with sound effects. Tell me how seriously we should take this.
Well, yeah, in his restaurant in the Fat Duck, he'll serve you a scallop, and it comes with an MP3 player, which you are encouraged to put in your ears, and you hear the sound of the sea while you're eating the scallop. So you have this kind of... sounds silly, doesn't it? It's a surround sound sensory experience. And he also has, you know, dishes where the waiter will, you know, come behind you and squirt lavender perfume at you while you're eating something else. So, yeah, it's slightly authoritarian. It's slightly Wagnerian. He wants to give you a Gesamtkunstwerk, a total work of art, in which there's no room to kind of think about anything else. But I think that's not what a convivial dinner should be.
Well, this is silly, but it's harmless, though, isn't it?
Of course it's harmless. And I'm sure it's very enjoyable to go there if you've got the cash. But I just don't want to say, you know, he's one of the world's great artists. I mean, what's interesting about Blumenthal, of course, is that you can't cook his stuff at home because you require liquid nitrogen and a centrifuge and, you know, a nuclear reactor in your backyard. And so his first book, which required all this equipment, it's just a kind of, you know, porn fantasy. His second book then said, oh, this is stuff you can actually cook at home, thus admitting that the first book was stuff you couldn't cook at home at all. And he's also interesting because foodists admire him, and they also hate processed food, and yet Heston gets a lot of his techniques from industrial food processing. So the whole fashion of sous vide, of boiling stuff in a vacuum soup sealed bag, apparently that was invented by the industrial food processors. So there's a kind of paradox there, which people aren't very alert to.
You went to one of his restaurants and had a dish called meat fruit. Can you describe what that was and what the experience was like?
It was a wonderful, you know, so it comes on a chopping board, of course, because nothing comes on a plate anymore, and it looks like a mandarin, an orange mandarin with a green stalk, and then you approach it with your knife and the skin gives way very easily, and it's actually a rather delicious chicken pate. And this was allegedly a dish that was invented in the 15th century. And there's a long tradition of trickery food. It's like trompe l'œil, but for food, so I don't know, trompe la bouche or something. But yeah, you think it's one thing, and it turns out to be another.
Yeah, that strikes me often. His approach to cooking strikes me as quite perverse a lot of the time. And it seems to come from, and I have to say this, a very British instinct to want to disguise the origin of the food. It's very different from Italian or French or Chinese cooking, which seems to have a kind of relationship to the food, that where it comes from. You seem to know what you're eating. It seems to want to hide that because the thought of the soil or the kind of the filthy animal that your food has come from is unbearable to the average British person.
Interesting. You think we're more Puritan than that?
I think you're way more Puritan.
Well, but of course, there's a tradition in with the great French chefs and, you know, back to the Romans of producing tricksy food where, you know, there was a famous Roman feast where they cut open a boar and live birds flew out, and then the servants had to run around and catch the birds and strangle them and run off and cook them, while other amazing things kept coming out of this boar, and it was like a, you know, disgusting sort of circus, what's going to come next. So it's a kind of childish, tricksy humour to all this, but I would resist the idea that it's necessarily just British.
Well, I'm going to come back at you on that, because I lived in Britain for a while and ate food there that was so appalling at times that people went out of their way and spent extra time to make it bad. I remember going in Scotland once, eating breakfast with a friend, and we ordered this kind of fried breakfast, which was just inedible. And part of it was this slab of, you know, filthy haggis and this dirty oil and greasy bacon. And when I ordered orange juice, I was given Fanta. And my Scottish friend said, "Ah, real food at last." Sometimes I think this kind of perverse attitude to bad food that just now turned into this excessive fussiness is two sides of the same coin. It betrays a kind of anxiety about British, and quite a British anxiety to food.
Well, it's true. I mean, a lot of people have come back at my book and said, but don't you realise British food was so disgusting back in the day? And of course, it's true that even as late as the 50s, you could only buy olive oil in Britain in a chemist. and it was labelled for external use only. So, yeah, those were the bad old... You could smear olive oil over your body, but you shouldn't put it in your mouth. Get, you know, nasty foreign muck. So we do have that kind of suspicious attitude. And, of course, it's got better since the rise of the gastropub and the foodist. But, you know, it's just gone too far now. And it's become excessive, not only in Britain, but, you know, in Canada, in North America, in Australia. I mean, that's, yeah, there's stuff at the Writers' Week here. There's stuff on the menu in the cafe. I don't even understand what it is. I would have to Google it. So it's become more foodist everywhere.
You need your smartphone in order to understand what you're eating. I want to play something else from another comedy series, because this is also such ripe material for comedy, isn't it? From a brilliant American series called Portlandia, which is sort of like, it's based in Portland, Oregon, which is a bit like the Australian-American equivalent of Byron Bay in some ways. Here's a couple in a restaurant, and they want to order the chicken, but they need to know a lot about the chicken that they've ordered.
If you have any questions about the menu, please let me know.
I guess I do have a question about the chicken, if you could just tell us a little bit more about it.
The chicken is a heritage breed, woodland-raised chicken that's been fed a diet of sheep's milk, soy, and hazelnuts.
Okay, this is local?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm going to ask you just one more time, and it's local?
It is.
Is that USDA organic or Oregon organic or Portland organic?
It's just all across the board, organic.
The hazelnuts, these are local?
How big is the area where the chickens are able to roam free?
I'm sorry to interrupt. I have exactly the same question.
4 acres. They do a lot to make sure that their chickens are very happy.
When you say they, I mean, who are these people raising Colin?
It's a farm that's located about 30 miles south of Portland.
And it's not some guy on a yacht who lives in Miami.
Oh,
who's
goodness,
just
no.
Saying that he's organic.
That's from Portlandia, Stephen. There is that obsession there of, you know, localism, organic. You sort of write in your book that you can see really good things in this idea of organic food and localism and all those kinds of things. But there are some hard questions that come out of the whole idea of organic and local
food. It's a nice idea that you go down to your farmer's market and you shake the hand of the guy who grew your apples, and, you know, you feel it's a way of repairing the urban community and everyone feels good about it. But if, as the Australian philosopher Peter Singer says, if you take the global view, it looks slightly more alarming, because think about the very poor farmer in Kenya, for example, who's trying to sell his green beans on the international market. And he's so poor that a tiny difference in his income might make the difference to him between being able to send his children to school or not. Well, if people in rich countries like ours are just patting each other on the back because we're eating each other's food and we're not buying his food, then it starts to look like we're a kind of smug, gated community of food, and we don't care about the rest of the world's problems. And even for farmers, I was debating this down in Albany at the wonderful Right in the Great Southern Festival, and we were having this debate in a local restaurant, and people were talking about how marvellous local food was. But then a local farmer spoke up and he said, well listen, I want to sell 1,800 sheep in the spring. Are you going to buy all my sheep? Are you going to buy 20 sheep each? No, I didn't think so. So I have to sell them further than that. You know, local eating is no good for me.
Is there enough land in the world to produce the food we need if it were to be all organically farmed?
Apparently there isn't. I mean, the math is kind of fuzzy, but if it were all organically farmed, no. And, you know, the great revolution of industrial farming, the new pesticides and fertilizers that were created in the 50s and 60s, prevented hundreds of millions of people in India from starving. You know, the great famines that used to happen regularly no longer happened. And, of course, then they were used to excess, and we had Rachel Carson's Silent Spring because it was too polluted. But the idea that we can go back to some agrarian idyll where there's farms as far as the eye can see is kind of nonsense, because you can't produce enough food on the land. And who's going to do all the backbreaking work of pre-industrial agriculture? It's a strange idea. You can sit there and think, well, I'm going to eat wonderful heirloom turnips, but who's actually doing the work for you?
And yet, the people who advocate sort of more ethical food, it seems that they do have an important point when they say the current model we have is unsustainable. It's not sustainable, is it? So there are some really hard questions to be
They're very hard questions. But the idea that you can do your moral duty just by buying the right kind of food, I think, is a dangerous idea. There was a study that just came out a couple of weeks ago, according to which, allegedly, buying organic food makes you nastier. If you buy organic produce, you are then less likely to be kind to other people. And the idea is because you feel you've kind of got your morality for the day in a packet. You've bought it. And so you no longer have any duty to other people.
Now, that sounds like silly pseudoscience to me.
It might be silly pseudoscience. I'm just reporting the headline. Who knows? This question obviously needs more research.
I suppose when you sort of follow these arguments about organic and farm space and how much of the Amazon basin is being torn down in order to create more pastures for the cattle industry, on and on it goes. Ultimately, you get to a point where someone will say, well, the world ultimately needs fewer people on it. And then you get to, well, which people are going to go?
This is what I find really disturbing, the kind of deep green misanthropy that you're led to. There's a local farmer who Michael Pollan talks to in one of his books, and eventually Michael Pollan says, yeah, it's great what you're doing, but you can't feed New York City on this model, can you? And he just says, yeah, but what use is New York City? Does it really have to exist? And this is kind of a misanthropic idea that you should raise the cities. And of course, living in cities is much better ecologically than the same population spread out, more widely over the land because you consume less energy. So these are much more difficult questions than they appear at first.
Vegetarian food is an interesting thing in England at the moment, particularly, once again, I always thought that suggested this underlying anxiety or a need to feel more virtuous.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, some vegetarians, of course, like some people of all descriptions, can be quite sanctimonious. I mean, personally, I'm afraid I'm rather intellectually convinced by the argument for vegetarianism, but I'm just, too lazy to do anything about it, and I like meat too much. But, I'm convinced that we don't really need to eat meat if we don't have to.
Have you been accused of being an enemy of pleasure? And is it true, sir? Are you an enemy of fun?
I have been accused. Some people misunderstand what I'm saying, and they call me some kind of Puritan scold. But the idea of the book is, I don't hate pleasure, and I don't hate food. I love food. I love a good roast chicken. I love a good burger. I love a good fish and chips. But I was down in Fremantle the other day, and there was this wonderful sign in the fish and chip shop saying, this restaurant is the home to the world's first fish and chip flavoured gelato.
Ooh.
Well, I thought how wonderful. They probably got to that idea before Heston Blumenthal made his crab ice cream. So, Australia takes precedence there. But no, that I think there's a spectrum. There's foodists on the one end who think about nothing but food, and there's fuelists who think of food only as fuel, and they resent the idea they even have to put food in their body to stay alive. And, most of us are somewhere in between, and we can take pleasure in our food, but, stop worrying too much about what other people are eating.
Vegetarians will often, though, report that there's a kind of an inverse sanctimony that they get. They get, this strange attitude they get, where they find that people who do eat meat are threatened by their vegetarianism and are kind of unreasonably hostile towards them in social situations.
Yeah, that can happen, and I do feel sorry for vegetarians sometimes. I know a Chinese woman who teaches me Tai Chi, and one of my fellow students once got a bit upset and ran away, and she said, philosophically, well, what do you expect? He's a vegetarian. But they're very no-nonsense, the Chinese.
Yeah, I know. It's like saying, they're like that because she's Sagittarius or something.
Yeah.
Gluttony. Gluttony, one of the seven deadly sins. But what did you find out those ancient moralists meant by the term?
It's gluttony. Interesting because these days we think of gluttony just as eating too much and we connect it with the obesity pandemic. But, the Catholic Church originally defined gluttony as being too interested in food, wanting food that was too elaborately prepared, as well as eating too much. So in that sense, the whole food mad culture we live in now, with food on the TV 12 hours a day and cookbooks everywhere in the bookshops, we're all gluttons and we're being educated into being gluttons, and everyone thinks that's okay.
The Roman historian Livy thought that gluttony, this kind of obsessive interest in food, was a mark of civilizational decline.
Yeah, the Roman armies brought back stuff from Asia, including sort of tapestries, and also a new veneration for the cook, who he said previously was treated as a kind of functionary, a respected servant in the kitchen. But then the cook started to be venerated as artists, and Livy said, yeah, that was the beginning of the downfall of the Roman Empire. And so perhaps our civilization is on the cusp of collapsing as well.
I don't know, he was writing at a time, though, when it was going to follow on to its very best days, though, so maybe he wasn't quite right about that.
Well, maybe we're entering a golden age.
Maybe we are entering
a
golden
hope so.
Age. Yeah. Stephen, it's fantastic to meet you. Thank you so much for being my guest today.
It's been a great pleasure. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.